It is Monday, October the 3rd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Colombians reject a peace deal.
I've never seen or heard of a plan B. What happens if country loses? There was a certain, they can't vote against this. It took 4 years to accomplish. Who doesn't want peace?
Russian involvement in Syria also ahead. The latest on the migrant crisis. Plus lots of goodbyes from the worlds of music, advertising, and sports. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Voters in Colombia rejected a peace deal with leftist rebels by a small margin in a national referendum on Sunday, delivering a major setback to President Juan Manuel Santos, who vowed to keep a ceasefire in place and not give up his campaign to end a half century of war. VOA's Celia Mendoza was there for the vote and tells us about the uniqueness of the process.
This is a unique process. This is the second time Colombians actually go to a plebiscite. They did it in 1957 when they were changing the constitution to actually allow women to vote and to create something called Frente Nacional, which it was a type of government that Colombians had. This is the only time that we have been able, as Colombians and Colombians in the world, to vote in something like this. Very personal, very unique, and it is the first time that we have a peace process where not the civil society pressure for it, but the actual parts on the war, the government and the FARC, who had been fighting each other, decided to actually go to a peace process, and now they're bringing it to the civil society to actually make it come through.
That is VOA's Celia Mendoza in Bogota, with almost all the polling stations reporting now 50.2% of ballots oppose the peace accord with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, also known as FARC, while 49.8% favored it. It was a difference of less than 57,000 votes out of a total of 13 million cast. Pre-election polls had predicted a yes vote would win by almost a 2-to-1 margin. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Peter Hockham. He is President Emeritus and Senior Fellow of the Inter-American Dialogue, that's a Washington-based think tank on Western Hemisphere affairs.
Clearly, the polling was inaccurate, and if you look at where the votes, clearly the peace won, yes to the peace treaty, won in most of the larger cities, in many of the coastal areas. It was in the mountainous central part of Colombia that it lost. This is a rough part of the country, a very rural part. Very difficult part, and where former President Uribe comes from and is extremely popular. My sense was that he managed to really drum up votes in where he was powerful, popular political figure.
Well, he was opposed to the treaty, and why?
Right. Well, he felt that it was inadequate. That the FARC, many of them were criminals. They had committed heinous acts against civilians, and they deserved more than the rather light punishment that was being complicated, if any punishment at all. And he also strongly opposed the notion that the FARC should be allowed to participate in Colombia politics. He viewed them as really outlaws, criminals, and he just never felt comfortable with the idea of a almost sort of equal negotiation arriving at an agreement, giving parity to the two sides, the government and the guerrillas. He long thought that the government should have done more to impose its will and impose justice on the FARC.
The rebel leader has still expressed his group's willingness to work toward peace after the defeat of the referendum. Does that suggest that fighting will not necessarily resume automatically?
Well, it's just very hard to make any predictions. I've never seen or heard of a plan B. What happens if country loses? There was a certain, they can't vote against this. It took 4 years to accomplish. Who doesn't want peace? If the agreement isn't perfect, it's better than any potential alternative. And I think that the country is really unprepared for this. And it's just very hard to see all of the implications a couple of hours after the polls close. But I think, portion of the Colombian political elite that participated in the Santos government and in the negotiations and supported this really suffered a terrible loss. This was not only Santos's loss, it was really a loss, a broader loss for his government. I think that it's going to be a very hard set of issues to work through now. What happens next? The guerrillas will want their weapons back. The military will probably say, no, we're going to keep them in the places where they're now occupied. We're not going to let them go back. I mean, there's going to be some people on both sides that want to sort of continue the negotiations, but there's going to be people on the extremes of both. This is the opportunity to really do in the FARC once and for all.
That is Peter Hockham, President Emeritus, Senior Fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue here in Washington. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. The situation in Syria and in the northern city of Aleppo in particular continues to deteriorate as a humanitarian disaster unfolds there. Meantime, U.S. relations with Russia are also worsening because of the crisis. International Edition's Lori London speaks with Jamil Jaffer. He is Adjunct Professor of Homeland and National Security Law at George Mason University School of Law.
The situation in Syria has, gotten, worse, not better. The notion of a ceasefire has largely fallen apart. Our effort to work with the Russians, always sort of, problematic from the jump, has appeared to have gotten worse. I mean, the Russians have very successfully been able to decimate the moderate opposition that we support, and then turn to us and blame us for not working hard enough against the Al-Qaeda affiliate there in the region, what used to be called the Nusra Front, which, of course, none of which is true. But the Russians, now trying to say the reason that they're not doing what they said they were going to do, because we said we weren't going to what we were going to do. And none of that's accurate, but it's not surprising given the Russians' sort of own goals in the region.
They also pretty much threatened the U.S. not to try to go after government forces, that it would create a spiral effect and complete chaos in the Middle East.
Yeah, our stated policy is a Syria without an Assad government, as well as the removal of areas of control from ISIS control. We've not been successful in either of those efforts, unfortunately. We have made some tactical gains against ISIS. They've gained some of those territories back, but we've made some efforts against ISIS. With respect to the Syrian government, however, contrary to actually making gains against them, they're actually now continuing to be more successful with the support of the Russians that you see in Aleppo. They've really turned the situation there in Aleppo. They had a success in Palmyra a while back. Some of those successes are good for us. Syrian government success against ISIS helps us in the fight against ISIS, but it doesn't help the humanitarian situation in Syria, nor does it help our apparent longer-term goal of a Syria without an Assad government.
Ban Ki-moon recently said, these are crimes against humanity. These are war crimes, when you start bombing hospitals. How is Russia allowed to break international war crime law and not be held accountable?
The Assad regime has been using chemical weapons for quite a while. So the attacks against hospitals, the attacks against the aid convoy in September, there have been claims about, these were mistakes and there were errors. But, a single mistake is understandable. A number of them in a row seems like a plan, just like Russia's claims that they didn't intentionally hit the moderate rebels that we were supporting after having agreed not to do so. But again, this is just another aspect of a larger flaunting of international law by Russia and by its client state, the Syrian regime. As I was saying earlier, the Syrians have used chemical weapons. They violated our red line. we did nothing about it. They allegedly, with this, in our deal with Russia, handed over all their chemical weapons, and yet, you know, day after day, we see chlorine attacks against Syrian civilians. I mean, we've even seen some sarin and mustard gas attacks, and so these are very troubling signs. And the Russians are not doing their part, not doing the part in the bargain that we agreed to with them back you know, a couple few years back, and certainly not doing their part in the effort against against ISIS and the Al Qaeda affiliate on the former Al Nusra front.
Jamil Jaffer of George Mason University speaking with my colleague Lori London. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This is VOA's International Edition. Tens of thousands of migrants have landed on Italy's southern shore since the beginning of the year, and those numbers are increasing every week, most of the arrivals out of Africa. Also, Italy's migrant centers are running out of money to support the migrants. The Italian Red Cross, which has about 70 migrant centers, has gone for months with no financial help. Rome-based reporter Josephine McKenna speaks with VOA's Kim Lewis about the growing crisis.
The flow of migrants has slowed down a little bit, but yes, over 130,000, mostly African migrants, have landed in Italy since the beginning of 2016. We've seen the introduction of European Union hotspots, these hotspots which are processing centres to help identify people at their first point of entry. But as you might recall, many migrants in Italy don't want to be identified in Italy. They don't want to be forced to remain in Italy. They want to get to other European countries. At the moment, though, many of the migrant centres in Italy are struggling to cope with the flow of migrants that we've seen, and the government funding is running out. So there's a real crisis in these centres not having enough money to be able to deal with the number of migrants that are being housed there.
I understand that the Interior Minister has a plan that he's going to be revealing. Do you know anything about this plan, and does it sound like it will help?
Well, many local communities across Italy say that they are not coping with the number of migrants, and there's a feeling that there's been a very uneven distribution of migrants across the country. The Interior Minister, Angelino Alfano, is expected to unveil a new plan for redistributing the migrants more fairly to ensure that the burden is shared on the basis of 2.5 asylum seekers for every 1,000 residents. Many cities like Rome and Milan have hundreds of migrants. Milan has even up to 3,000 migrants at the moment. So there's a feeling that the flow, the burden needs to be distributed more fairly across different communities.
Also, there's been a repatriation process going on there. Can you tell us about that and what migrants have been returned to their homelands?
Recently, the Italian government sent 40 migrants back to Sudan. And there's been a bit of a concern about that from NGOs and welfare agencies, saying that when a Sudanese migrant leaves his homeland, travels across Libya, takes a boat across the Mediterranean to arrive in Italy, they are really struggling to escape from their homeland, probably have a good reason. Just the fact that they don't ask for protection in Italy is not a good enough reason to send them back home. And there are fears that their lives might be in danger when they are sent back home. So there are grave concerns from a human rights point of view, and Catholic organizations have also expressed their concerns about this particular policy. Even though there's pressure in Europe, in Italy and other European countries, to repatriate more migrants and try and stop the flow, discourage these people from coming into Italy illegally.
Also, there's been an arrest of some of the people smugglers. What is going on in that area?
We've seen several arrests over the summer months in Italy of alleged people smugglers, and two presumed people smugglers from Senegal and Mali were arrested in relation to a voyage off the Libyan coast. And one of them was in charge of a dinghy that was carrying around 132 migrants. Italian authorities are trying to intercept more people smugglers, but that doesn't seem to have discouraged them, and the flow of migrants is continuing.
That is Josephine McKenna. She is a Rome-based reporter, and she was speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. Well, it is time now to see what's trending online with our social media expert, G. Abby Lee. As always, she is here with hashtags, buzzwords, and so much more. What you got, G?
Hola, Steve. And I'm talking about the Jewish holiday bread. Social media users are talking about the Jewish New Year, also known as Rosh Hashanah. And not surprisingly, Rosh Hashanah is a trending hashtag at this hour. During this holiday, Jewish families enjoy two nights of dinners, apples, honey, and of course, the braided bread, challah. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau took to Twitter to send a video message to the Jewish community. His handle is @JustinTrudeau. American President Barack Obama also sent a video message through Twitter. But this time, the White House account shared a clip of his phone conference with rabbis around the country. That's a little different from the traditional way of sending holiday messages by talking directly into the camera. The video is up on the White House Twitter account, and the caption reads like this: Shana Tova, wishing a sweet and healthy new year to all those celebrating hashtag Rosh Hashanah.
Yes, indeed. Of course, a sweet and healthy new year to all of those celebrating Rosh Hashanah. Anything else out there trending, G?
Steve, if you're a fan of the Star Wars series, you're going to love this news. There's a new Star Wars merchandise that people are talking about quite a bit online. It's the R2-D2 coffee press. And R2-D2, as you know, is a robot character in the series. And now you can buy a French press that looks just like it.
So what's so special about this product? I mean, does it do anything special?
Absolutely nothing. It just looks like a robot, but works like any other manual French press. It's priced at less than $40 in the U.S., which is not any more expensive than regular French press, so a lot of people are talking about the pre-order opportunities. But some people are tweeting they can't really believe more than 400,000 people are talking about a coffee press. Steve, back to you.
Just what I wanted, G. A French press that looks like a robot, huh? Yeah, everybody wants one. The guys in the control booth over there are just jump up. They're probably ordering it online right now, aren't you? Thanks a lot, G. International Editions, G. Abby Lee. I want to remind you, you can find G. on Twitter @GAbbyLee. I'm there as well, if you dare, @VOANorman. Our program, International Edition, on Twitter @VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency's comet-chasing Rosetta mission ended its 12-and-a-half-year mission on Friday, September 30th, with a controlled crash into comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. Rosetta had been studying the comet since its arrival on August 6, 2014. One of the most significant and exciting findings was the discovery of an amino acid called glycine in its atmosphere. Amino acids are one of the important building blocks that make life possible and are considered to be the foundation of all life processes. As the Rosetta headed toward the comet's surface, it continued to send back information about the comet's gas, dust, and what its plasma environment was like very close to its surface. The spacecraft also gathered and sent back some very high-resolution images of 67P. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. One of country music's trailblazing artists has died. Honky Tonk singer-songwriter Jean Shepherd passed away, complications from Parkinson's and heart disease. She was 82. International edition Sarah Williams talks about her legacy with VOA One's Nikki Strong.
Well, Nikki, before Loretta Lynn and Tammy Wynette, there was Jean Shepherd.
Yes, to use her words, when there was none of us, there was Jean. She was in the business when there were very few female role models and even fewer female solo country artists, especially successful ones. There was Kitty Wells, basically. And at the beginning of her career, when she met Hank Williams, for example, she told him she wanted to be a country music star. And he told her, oh, yeah, well, there isn't much room in this business for a country woman singer. And she said that really made her determined to do what she loved. And her determination paid off. She was the first female country artist to go on tour by herself.
Wow.
Now, this wasn't heard of, because during that time, when women performed on tour, they either performed with their husbands, or they performed with, like, a family band, or they performed with a band, but they were just called, like, the girl singers with a band. So she also sang music from a woman's perspective. So an example is The Root of All Evil is a Man. In which she warns women that men can be liars and cheaters and callous about breaking your heart. In her song, Second Fiddle to an Old Guitar, which is a really funny song, she sings about a man who loves his guitar so much that she just feels second rate. You know, she's tired of playing second fiddle to an old guitar. She's also been credited with releasing country music's first concept album called Songs from a Love Affair back in 1956. And she was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 2011. Many people felt that was way overdue when it finally came. And so she's had a considerable number of hits as well. And her success, of course, opened doors for Tammy Wynette, for Patsy Cline, and of course, later on, Loretta Lynn.
Well, Jean Shepherd became known as the Grand Lady of the Grand Ole Opry.
Yes, that too. She joined in 1955. She was the third woman to join after comedian Minnie Pearl and the first female country star, Kitty Wells. And I think it's important to note that both Kitty Wells and Jean Shepherd were very successful because of how powerful the Grand Ole Opry was. The Grand Ole Opry, for people who don't know, is a pioneering, longest-running live country music program that dates back to 1925. So even Jean was listening to the Grand Ole Opry before she even joined. She was listening to it as she was growing up. So any country artist who's deep into country knows about the Grand Ole Opry. They're very influential. They have grown to be an iconic country music institution and a curator and a gatekeeper of country music's legacy. So their influence really helped make her a star.
Well, now, Jean Shepherd was a staunch supporter of traditional country music as well.
Most definitely, especially as part of the Grand Ole Opry and a honky-tonk singer. For a while, it was hard for her. I mean, she had several hits, and then for a while, it was hard for her to land another hit because Nashville was pushing a more country pop sound. And in 1974, I think this is interesting, when pop artist Olivia Newton-John was named Female Vocalist of the Year by the Country Music Association, the Association of Country Entertainers was formed, and Jean Shepherd served as its president. And she was known to say something like, I'm sure Olivia Newton-John was a great lady, but she didn't sing country music. She also went in on Blake Shelton, and I think this is funny too. He made a derogatory comment about country music traditionalists. And she said, and this is a quote, we've got a young man in country music who has made some pretty dumb statements lately. What did he say? That traditional country music is for old farts and jack-you-know-whats? Well, I guess that makes me an old fart. I love country music. I won't tell you what his name is, but his initials is BS, and he's full of it. She was great. I think that really captures her spirit.
Yeah. Well, you can find out more about Jean Shepherd and hear both traditional and contemporary country music on Country Hits with Nikki Strong. You can also share your thoughts on Jean Shepherd on Twitter and Facebook at VOA1 The Hits. Thanks very much, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Once we were so happy, you were my very own. But then you bought that guitar and you ruined our happy home. You told me that you're gonna pick, you're gonna be a star. I'm tired of playing second fiddle to an old guitar. You gaze at that guitar on your knee in a way that you never look at me. This love affair of yours is gone.
Oh, yeah. Jean Shepherd certainly was something else. If you didn't ever know who she was, look up the video. She's amazing. Richard Trentledge, who wrote the Oscar Mayer Wieners song and some other catchy advertising jingles, has died. He was 87. Here's the audio from a 1965 TV commercial for Oscar Mayer Wieners.
Oh, I'd love to be an Oscar Mayer Wiener. That is what I truly like to be. 'Cause if I were an Oscar Mayer Wiener, everyone would be in love with me.
A big parade is so inspiring.
Oh, I'm glad I'm not an Oscar Mayer Wiener. That is what I never want to be. 'Cause if I were an Oscar Mayer Wiener, there would soon be nothing left of me. Oh, I love to be an
Oscar Mayer Wieners are all meat, all good meat, rich and complete meat protein, mildly seasoned to bring out all the good meat flavor.
Everyone would be in love with me.
Next week, you handle just the refreshments, Freddy.
Yeah, Freddy gets the refreshments. I love it. That's cute. Besides the work for Oscar Mayer, Richard Trentledge wrote jingles for McDonald's, the restaurants, the U.S. National Safety Council, and V8 Juice. Can you believe it? Had a can of that before it came to work today. Well, one last story for you. Vin Scully's iconic voice on the video board welcomed a sellout crowd to game number 162, the regular season finale on Sunday, and the career finale for the famed sports announcer. Scully attended morning mass in the ballpark, as is usual on Sunday. It's his routine. Then headed for the booth to do some work there. He's done that for an astounding 67 years, exactly 80 years it is, after he became a Giants fan, age 8 in the Bronx. Of course, the Giants now play in San Francisco, and the Los Angeles Dodgers were once in Brooklyn, New York, where Scully began his play-by-play career in 1950. On Sunday, it turned out that the Giants took the Dodgers 7-1. Well, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned for the latest world news coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On September 23rd, at a Lake Chad Basin side event at the UN General Assembly, the United States pledged an additional $41 million in funding to meet emergency needs for conflict-affected and vulnerable households in the Lake Chad Basin. This additional funding to UN and NGO partners will ensure tens of thousands of people receive critical humanitarian assistance, including emergency food assistance, safe drinking water, and shelter support, as well as interventions to address acute hygiene, nutrition, and protection needs. According to the United Nations, there are more than 2.5 million internally displaced persons and more than 169,000 refugees living in the Lake Chad Basin. During the Lake Chad Basin side event, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, highlighted the pervasive food insecurity in the region. Ambassador Power stated that the crisis is so severe that an estimated 134 children will die every day of severe malnutrition in Nigeria's Borno state unless treated. And this is just a sliver of the consequences if we come up short on raising enough funds, she said. The United States has now provided more than $359 million in humanitarian aid to this region since 2015. The United States continues to be the largest donor to the area. At the recent high-level meeting, donors pledged $163 million of the $542 million needed between September and December. In addition to the U.S., major donors include Belgium, Italy, and Britain. The United States urges other donors to fulfill their pledged contributions and consider donations of additional humanitarian assistance for the millions of people in the region whose lives have been devastated by Boko Haram's senseless violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.
It's 4 hours